Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We're currently working our way through the book of Revelation in our study of eschatology. Visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are in Revelation 20, and we have for several months now been hanging around Revelation 20, and we have looked and let the amillennialists make their argument, and we have looked at the church Israel replacement arguments, and I've tried my best to lay that stuff out in front of you all as honestly as I possibly could, to say, here is their argument, here is what they believe and why they believe it. I've let them speak through their own writing. I read it word for word so nobody could say that I edited things or mischaracterized or misappropriated anything, and put it all out in front of you. And the end result of it is, and I asked a couple of times in the course of us going through all that material, I kept asking, is anyone convinced? And invariably, the group all says, no, we're not convinced. And I kept asking the question, why? Why are you not convinced? And the answer is, because the text plainly says what the text says. Now, what I was going to do this evening, this is Kenneth Woos' New Testament Expanded Translation, one of my favorite translations. As you can tell by how dog-eared the cover is and how yellowed the pages are, it's a copy I've had for a very long time and use extensively. This is the Sits By My Bed copy, and I use it as a reference a lot as I do his word studies in Greek. I like this translation because so many translations try to find a parallel English word for the Greek word, and then we'll reposition the sentence so that it makes more sense in the English, regardless of how the original Greek text read. Oftentimes in the original Greek text, they will put predicates before subjects, which in the English, no. In the English, you've got to introduce your subject, and then you can go on to your verbs and your predicates and your predicate nominatives. And right? Hey, you've been reading all this, haven't you? Yeah, so in the Greek, oftentimes, if what the writer was trying to emphasize was the action more than the actor, they would position it that way. Well, one of the things that Kenneth Woos does is keep the Greek structure and tense the same as it was in the original text, which makes it read a little odd when you read it in English words. It feels strange to us, but it really helps to open up some of those passages. So I've got that. And now this is my parallel edition of the four translations of the New Testament. This is the King James Version, the New American Standard Bible, William's translation, which is the New Testament in the language of the people, and Beck's New Testament in the language of today. So this is four translations in parallel. Looks like this, so that you can read it side by side and read your King James and your New American Standard and then your Williams and your Beck. Now I've got all these, but then of course on my computer, I have the New American Standard update, I've got the New English Translation, I've got the New American Standard, I've got the English, what's yours, ESV, English Standard Version. So I've got a lot of other versions, including a lot of much older versions as well, all on my computer. And I've been doing over the course of the last couple of weeks a basic exercise that we're going to do here tonight, which is that we're going to read Revelation 20 out of several different translations. And what you're going to discover, I'm going to tell you this right up front, and then we get to go through the more tedious exercise of actually doing it. What I'm going to tell you up front is that there is unanimity between the translators in the numbers, the subject matter, the order of appearance, the consequences, the activity, all of that across the board. There is not a translator, get this in your head, there is not a translator that varies away from the ideas, the order, who the actors are, what the actors do, what their motivation is, the number 1,000, every single translation runs exactly concurrent because the original text. Now, when I say original text, remember that we have at this point 5,000 or more texts to go back and look at. We have some that go back as early as the early 200s AD. The text has continued unabated. It's just simply that clear. So when we say, well, we are convinced of our position because the text is clear, I make that statement a lot. I'll say, well, the text is clear. This is one of those instances where the text is just so clear that there are no translators out there that say anything different than all the other translators say because the text is that clear. There are passages in John that translators will discuss and argue about. I don't know if you know that, say, the story of the woman caught in adultery is not in some of the oldest texts. And so oftentimes in your newer translations, you'll see a note out to the side where they'll let you know that this isn't found in some of the earliest texts, and some of the more respected manuscripts may or may not include this. That is a true, genuine textual variant. That is a place where when you look at different textual traditions, you'll find actual changes or differences to the text itself. And you can say, that's a textual variant. And we can discuss and argue, and no matter how much we like that story, we have to come to the realization that historically there's some controversy about that particular piece of the text. Nothing like that in Revelation 20. Nothing that would lead to the now 1600 year argument about Revelation 20 and what it means. For the first 300 years of the church, not only was there unanimity in the text, there was unanimity of thought. For the first 300 years of the church, the chiliastic view, the literal thousand-year view, and the return of Christ to set up a 1,000-year kingdom on earth wasn't argued anywhere. None of the church fathers argue against it. So why do I continue to pound for the premillennial view, even though it isn't the most popular Reformed or Calvinistic view? Because it's what the text actually says. And when I argue for, well, predestination, someone says, how can you argue for predestination? I go, well, because it's what the text says. It's right in Romans 8. It's right in Ephesians 1. Have you read Colossians? I mean, it's in the text. When Peter writes to the church and says that you were chosen in Christ before the foundation of the world, that's where I get that stuff. It's right in the text. So election, predestination, God's absolute sovereignty over everything. People say, where do you get that? Well, because it's in the text. And then when I say literal thousand-year millennium, on earth, kingdom, Jesus ruling, thousand years, Satan-bound, people say, where do you get that? Well, it's in the text. Well, that's not the Reformed view. The Reformed Calvinistic view is amillennial. Those things are all supposed to be interpreted in ways where you understand that the millennium is now and the kingdom is now and Christ is ruling on David's throne in heaven now. How David's throne got to heaven, they never explain. And that Christ right now is ruling, and that those who have died have gone through the first resurrection and are now ruling and reigning with Christ in heaven. And you say, where do you get all that? And they'll say, well, that's what the Reformers believed. So yeah, but is that what John believed? Is that what John wrote? Is that what the early church believed? Well, it's what Calvin believed. Are you aware that there was like no eschatological discussion for the 600 years leading up to Calvin? Why, no, I didn't know that. Well, history matters. What does the text say? This is where my real fundamentalist roots come out. Trying to put the fun back into fundamentalism. Or maybe I'm trying to put the mental back into fundamentalism. But this is where I become real fundamental. This is what the text says. So that's all introduction. You understand the argument?
Yep.
Okay. I think we're familiar with the King James Version of Revelation 20 because you've heard me read it in weeks past as we read the amillennial view. So let's read the American Standard Version of Revelation 20. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven with the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. He seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. I'm sorry, my eyes went down to Williams. I'm actually reading Williams at this point. I said I was going to read the New American Standard. I'll get to that in a moment. Then he hurled him into the abyss, closed it, sealed it over him to keep him from leading the nations astray anymore until the 1,000 years are at an end. After that, he must be let loose for a little while. Now that same passage out of the New American Standard. And I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him so that he should deceive the nations no longer until the 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. Now Beck, in the language of the common folks, then I saw an angel coming down from heaven with the key to the abyss in his hand and a big chain, and he took the dragon, that old snake, that is the devil or Satan, bound him for 1,000 years, threw him into the abyss, locked it and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations anymore till the 1,000 years were over. After that, he must be set free for a short while. Now we're going to read that same passage from Kenneth Woost. Are you getting a feel for this? Yeah, it's the sameness that I'm driving at. If I were to read these same translations on other passages, as often happens when I'm teaching from the King James, people will raise their hand and say, well, my translation says something slightly different, or there's a variation here, or there's a verb tense that's slightly different. What I want you to see here is the unanimity of thought. And so Kenneth Woo says, and I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having a key to the bottomless place, and a great chain upon his hand, and he seized the dragon in one fell swoop, that snake, the ancient snake who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he threw him into the bottomless place and locked him and sealed it over him in order that he should not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years have been brought to an end. After these things, it is of a necessity in the nature of the case for him to be set free for a brief period. There is no conflict, no contradiction between each of these translations because the text is that plain. Are we getting the point? I know I'm a repetitionist. I realize that I'm on the verge of boring you with this. But I'm just trying to prove the same old case. That is, I don't care if you go back to the Greek text. I don't care if you look at the ancient English text. If you look at the modern English text, the text all say the same thing. So if you say, in your interpretive scheme, something different than what the text says, not only does the text not give you that liberty because the text is so clear and precise, and importantly, understandable, it's not like the text is saying anything vague. You're not given that liberty from the text, which means that you are exercising something called eisegesis. It's the opposite of exegesis. It's a word that means that you are putting something into the text rather than pulling out from the text. You are imposing your ideas on the text. And it is that method, that exercise of imposing ideas onto the text that have led to every great schism in the church. People who say, well, yes, the text says this, but I also will impose, fill in the blank, Mariology. I also will impose, you are saved by baptism. I also will impose, you have to choose Christ because he would never force himself on you. I will put on the text the idea that God is love and only love, and that's his primary attribute, and everything else he does flows through his love. All of those are ideas that do not exist anywhere in the text, but have been imposed on the text eisegetically by people who had a particular axe to grind, theologically or philosophically. And so, if you just stand on the text of Revelation 20, I'm not going to read all of Revelation 20 in all five of the different versions I have in front of me. We're going to continue on in the New American Standard, because it seems to be the easiest to read here. And I just want you to understand that as I'm reading the New American Standard, every other text agrees with it. There are no arguments, there are no historical variations outside of what the text actually says. Have I driven that point home enough? Mm-hmm. Okay. Because there are lots of people out there saying, now when you get to Revelation 20 verse 1, that is suddenly a recapitulation for the seventh time of everything else that was said in Revelation up until now. You go, well, where's that in the text? It's not. But my method demands it.
Now, or, is this pretty much true of all of Revelation?
In terms of wording, yes. Because it is apocalyptic in its language, because it does introduce figures, you know, a woman with a cup in her hand riding on a dragon. What it does is it invites interpretation. And so the method that we have used now for the, how many years has it taken us? We're nearly done, too. But for several years of working our way through Revelation, what we have found is that every one of the symbols that you find in the book of Revelation is found somewhere else in Scripture. You can find that same figure either spelled out or alluded to somewhere else in Scripture where it is identified and is interpreted for you. So you never really have to go outside of the corpus of the Bible to find proper interpretation for those symbols. But if you spend all your time emphasizing the New Testament to the exclusion of the Old, which so many people do, then you think that once you find these symbols, they're like a license to interpret. Next thing you know, you have all these eisegetical ideas. So now, we're continuing on in Revelation 20. I conclude that what the first three verses are telling us is that John saw an angel. Remember, a basic rule of interpreting the book of Revelation is nobody knows more about what John saw than John does. That's just a rule. John saw it. John was told to write it down. John wrote it down. Nobody knows more about what John saw than John does. So if John says that he saw an angel, I take it to mean that what he's saying is he saw an angel. Is that too tough? I saw an angel coming down from heaven and having a key to the abyss. The abyss, Greek word that also means bottomless or open space. We have a hard time conceiving in our Western thinking, Aristotelian minds. It's hard for us to conceive of bottomless. But bottomless pit is essentially what it means. A place where he would be held for a period of time. And that angel laid hold on the dragon, that serpent of old who is the devil and Satan, bound him for 1,000 years. I believe what that means is that Satan will be, future tense, bound for 1,000 years. Remember that John would have written this from 91 to 96 AD, somewhere in that period. If it is true that the 1,000-year millennial Christ ruling on his throne period started at the cross, then why would John be writing future tense that Satan would be someday bound? If the event had already happened back at the cross, somewhere in that 33 to 35 AD period, if what he was describing here was the fall of Jerusalem 70 AD, then why is he still speaking of these events as something that's still going to happen? He sees it as an angel that is going to do these things, and Satan is going to be bound at some point in the future, so that the nations could not be deceived. If we are living in the millennial period right now, then Satan has been bound for more than 1,000 years, so John was inaccurate there. But that 1,000-year period during which Satan was bound, the nations could no longer be deceived. And I just don't know how any rational person can say that Satan is not only in the bottomless pit, but a seal is placed on him, and that he is sealed in the abyss so that he can no longer actively deceive people, if he is in that condition right now, and the world is in the condition it's in now, imagine how ugly it's going to get when he gets let go. I'm much more prone to say he's quite active right now, and that this binding in this sealing is still a future thing to come, which falls perfectly in line with the notion that Christ would return, set up his 1,000-year kingdom, and that during the 1,000 years that Christ is ruling on earth, of course Satan would have to be put away and sealed, because he is called the prince of this world, the prince of the power of the air. And you're not going to have two rulers fighting for dominion during that 1,000 years. For the 1,000 years that Christ is ruling and reigning on planet earth, which I believe is a physical reality, the return of Christ, the same way that as Christ left the planet in view of his apostles, an angel stood there and said, look, he's coming back. And the Christian church has for 2,000 years been anticipating that event. And if we know anything about Christ, it's that he will get all the preeminence. He is not going to come back to earth and then share his lordship or his rulership with any other prince or any other power here on earth. He is going to seal Satan away, and for 1,000 years he is going to rule and reign without any competition. And that makes complete sense to me. That is the way that a God who is truly a sovereign God would act. So then, he's sealed up so that he could no longer deceive the nations. And then look at the next word. Until the 1,000 years were completed. Everybody agrees with what the Greek phrase there means. Every interpreter agrees that it means he will be bound and he will be sealed until the 1,000 years are up. That means there's an actual ending point to the 1,000 years. Which, to my way of thinking, and I would think the way of thinking of any rational, logical person, if you say 1,000 years until 1,000 years end, then you're using 1,000 years in a limited way. You're not saying 1,000 years as a large, random expanse of time, which is the way the amillennialists would like us to think. that it just means large expanse, random number, not specific, amount of time. Except that if you say 1,000 years and then limited 1,000 years, and when the 1,000 years are over, that's very specific language that means this number and no other number but this. He's using it in a very mathematical, arithmetical way. And so then, after the 1,000 years are completed, he's going to be released for a short time. That event is picked up in a few verses, and we're going to see it, that he is released, that he does immediately go into perdition, completely in keeping with his character, and immediately assembles an army. And where does he go? Heads straight for Jerusalem. He's going to surround the beloved city. Sort of like what we're seeing happen in the world right now. You have all those Middle Eastern nations all lining up, and the one thing they can agree on, they can't seem to agree on much of anything over there in the Middle East, but one thing they do agree on is, let's get rid of Israel. Let's push Israel into the sea. Let's nuke them into the Stone Age. Let's get rid of Israel. That's the one thing all the Middle Eastern nations agree on. Well, as soon as Satan is let out of the abyss, the first thing he does is assemble an army, and apparently has no trouble assembling people who are perfectly willing. And he goes after Gog and Magog, who are the ancient kings that are named in Ezekiel. Those are names for kings that rule in the territory that, I don't know how many of you were here 3-4 years ago when we read through Fred Zaspel's book, that identified Gog and Magog and all those nations. And we discovered that all those ancient names were not in Russia. Meshach and Tubal were ancient names for cities that now are in Turkey, that are now in ancient areas of Iraq. What a surprise. The same place that the descendants of Ishmael and the same place that the descendants of Esau have historically always been are the same place that the prophets of old saw as being the lifelong enemies of Israel. And sure enough, when Satan comes out of the abyss, he forms an army out of Gog and Magog, the same ancient enemies, and one more time they make one last gasp effort at trying to destroy the holy city. But that is as it has always been. I've said so many times, you cannot understand the history of the world if you don't understand your Bible, because there are too many things that happen geopolitically in the world that make absolutely no sense, which is why folks who don't know their Bible will go on talk shows and say things like, well, all we have to do to bring peace to the Middle East is just listen to them and understand them and appease them. And if we give them a little more understanding, it'll go easier for everybody and we'll all just hold hands and sing Kumbaya and it's just going to be fine. And it's because they have no rational explanation for why there is so much hatred against Israel. And the reason they have no rational explanation for it is that there is no rational explanation for the hatred against Israel. No group of people has been as systematically persecuted. No group of people has had as many attempts at extermination as God's people, Israel. But they're still here, and they're still locatable, and they're still right there on that piece of land God said was forever theirs. And that's just unavoidable. So sure enough, when Satan is going to be let out of the abyss, he is one more time going to try to turn over the covenant plan. And this just makes so much sense when you think about it in covenant terms. God told Abraham, I will give this land to you and your descendants everlastingly. You're always going to have this land. That is the first unconditional, everlasting covenant in the Bible. It's the first place where God said to a specific person, I will, by my grace, do this for you. And Paul picks up that particular covenant in the book of Galatians and points out that it was Abraham believing God that was then counted to him for righteousness. And Paul uses that as the basis for talking about imputed righteousness and saying that you cannot achieve righteousness on the basis of your works, and that that's taught all the way back at Abraham, who was told that he would have a natural son and that this land would always be his. He believed that, and God counted that to him, imputed that to him as righteousness. And this is a guy who was an idol worshiper when he was in Ur of the Chaldees. And God picked him out, not because he was good or had faith, but because God simply chose him and said, leave your father, leave your people, I'll show you a land. When you get there, I'll promise it to you forever. And he did exactly that. And so if Satan was going to try to overturn anything in the Bible, really put the effort forward to destroy some facet of the Bible, he's going to go after the Abrahamic covenant. That's the key to the whole thing. The new covenant came about as a result of the Abrahamic covenant. The new covenant is here as a result of the promises made to the forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Every time that Israel would turn and do all the regular hard-hearted, stiff-necked stuff that they would do, every time that it seemed that God's patience should have run out and that he should have said, I'm done with these people, they're just too difficult to deal with. Every time that happened, the Bible tells us God remembered the promise he made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And for that reason, he did not destroy them. So if Satan's going to go after anything, what's he going to go after? It's going to be taking those people off that land, proving once and for all that God didn't tell the truth. If he can just get those people wiped off the planet and out of that land, then that forever covenant made to Abraham has been completely expunged off planet Earth, and God isn't omnipotent, God isn't sovereign, God's a liar, God can't keep his word. Why wouldn't he go after that? And he's got 1,000 years in the abyss to think about it. And when he comes out, where does he go? Right there. What does he try to do? That same thing. I mean, we already read it earlier in the book of Revelation. The woman in the wilderness. Remember the woman in the wilderness with the sun and moon under her feet and the 12 stars over her head? What did we conclude that she stood for? She's an emblem of what? Yeah, she's clearly an emblem of Israel. You find that back in Genesis when Joseph has that very dream of the sun and the moon and the stars and how they all did obeisance to his star. And then you can read his father, Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, interpret. So we know that that's Israel. And who chases Israel in that story in Revelation? Satan, the dragon, goes out and tries to destroy the woman. She's driven into the wilderness where God prepares a place for her, takes care of her for 42 months, 1,260 days. It's that same thing. Satan is just, he's just geared in on Israel. He's just determined to get rid of Israel because he's determined to show that that Abrahamic covenant ain't true. And boy, if he can just wipe that one out, then everything else we know about God comes apart like a house of cards. And by the way, if it's true that the proper interpretation of the New Testament is that the church is now Israel, and Israel is the church, church replacement theology, then why is Satan still chasing physical Israel over here? Why is he still going after the beloved city? Why is he still going after Jerusalem? Shouldn't he be going after the church somewhere? I mean, after all, God's done with Israel, right? Israel's been replaced by the church. God's negated the covenant he made with them, negated that land covenant. The land covenant is now heaven. It's all symbolic. Satan doesn't seem to understand any of that symbology, and is still going after those people. I guess he just didn't have his theology straight. Why is he still going after them?
They're easier to identify.
Well, that could be, that's right. Easier to find. They're right there. They're in Jerusalem. Seems easy. It doesn't make any sense in the big scheme of things. You know, I'm a big fan of overarching theology. Because if you've got the big picture, then you know where to stick all those details. There is no way to have a consistent overarching view of the Bible and also adhere to amillennial church replacement, Israel replacement type theology. It makes no sense then, even the motivations of what you see happening here in Revelation 20 and Satan going after the Jews in specific, Israel at large, and the beloved city, Jerusalem. None of that makes any sense unless the literal 1,000-year millennial view is kept intact. Then all those motivations make sense. So I saw thrones, verse 4. I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them. I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of the testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God. And those who had not worshiped the beast or his image and had not received the mark upon their forehead and upon their hand, and they came to life and they reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Not only is 1,000 years brought up again in a very arithmetic sense, but let's talk for a moment realistically about what this mark is talking about. It says when we look at the final judgment, the white throne judgment coming up, everybody who takes that mark in their right hand or their forehead ends up judged, and they all end up in the lake of fire. So having the mark of the beast on your right hand and your forehead, is a very bad thing. And a demarcation that you are not in the Lamb's Book of Life, and that you belong to Satan, and everybody who has that mark ends up judged. Now, what is that mark then? Think about that mark. If you have that mark in your right hand and forehead, you are headed for the lake of fire. Says it very clearly coming up. So what is that mark then historically? If it's true that the church is now Israel, Israel church replacement is true, we're now living in the millennium, well then everybody who gets to heaven is ruling and reigning with Christ right now, well then that mark and the judgment for that mark is already in place. Where is that mark? What is the mark? What mark? Where's the mark? Ah, good, she caught up with me. I'm asking an all-mill person or church replacement person, what is the mark? Identify the mark.
Because I was like, you know what the mark is going to be?
Yeah. Pretty darned impressive, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, where is and what is that mark if the all-mill church replacement view is true? Because you have to be able to deal with the text. It would be somewhere, would it not? It would be identifiable in some real sense.
No.
I could be in trouble. It simply is a reality historically that even if you are going to identify the Roman emperors, particularly the first 10 Roman emperors, which is the standard all-mill interpretation of the ten-toed kingdom, if you're going to say, well, then that was the time of the beast, and if you're going to identify one of those Roman emperors as the beast, whether Nero or whether Caligula or Diocletian, whichever one, you know, you're going to say the persecution was the worst under, therefore he was the beast. Well, then fill it out. Where is the statue of the beast? And what was the mark of the beast? A mark so identifiable, it's said to be in particular body parts. Its right hand, its forehead. And so what is the mark in the right hand and the forehead that God hated so much that he was willing to put people in the lake of fire for it? What is that mark historically? There is no answer to that. Yeah, because there is no historic mark. So why does the book of Revelation make so much of that mark? We've been told earlier that that mark of the beast is the mark of the number of his name. No man can buy or sell without it. No man can trade without it. The book of Revelation says a lot about the mark of the beast, which is why you've got so many sensationalistic books out there about the mark of the beast.
Yeah, I mean, I thought you were hitting about to tell us what you thought the mark of the beast. I was like, okay, you're freaking out.
Yeah,
we don't know
because it hasn't happened yet. It's not here. We don't have it historically. And more importantly, if you're going to be consistent, if you're going to argue that the Bible supports your view, then every word of the Bible has to support your view. And so that's, again, where an amillennialist will stumble because he doesn't have an answer for what is that mark.
Right.
And you would have to be able to identify the mark because it is vitally important. Everybody with the mark is headed for the lake of fire. It doesn't get more important than that. And nobody whose name is in the Lamb's Book of Life takes the mark. These are really important distinctions. These are really big, important heaven and hell concepts. But it's something.
Say Christians did that, and they weren't forgiven for it. You see what I'm saying? That's very difficult to.
That's very, very difficult to say because you would only be talking about the higher echelons of Roman society at that point anyway, and this is so universal that it has to do with all mankind. You either are in the Lamb's Book of Life or you take the mark of the beast at that point in history. At whatever point the beast was on planet Earth, if he's a historic character, as opposed to being a future character, if he's a historic character, at whatever point in time he was on the Earth, there would also have to be a distinguishable mark in the right hand and forehead of those people who followed him. And you simply don't find anywhere in history any emperor insisting on putting a mark on people in their right hand and forehead. It just doesn't exist anywhere.
There's not even like a cult that did that.
Right, right. So, in our imagination, in the time we live in, if I said to you, Carol, there's going to be an electronic device that you're going to do your banking. Do you have any trouble conceiving of that? Anybody here doing online banking? Paying your bills online? Sure, we all do. Which means, anymore, the money that we all use isn't even money anymore. For my daughter's government economics class this year, I let her make copies. I wouldn't even let her take them. I let her make copies on my scanner of some of my silver certificates. Because I have actual silver certificates. Have you ever seen one? I mean, a silver certificate is a bearer bond created by the U.S. government saying that that amount of silver is on deposit at Fort Knox, and that you have the right as the bearer of that bond to go to Fort Knox and say, you know, give me my silver. And the government was not allowed to print more silver certificates, bearer bonds, paper money, than they actually had silver on deposit to cover that. And then the government decided, you know, we really need more money in circulation. We don't really have that much silver. And so they went from bearer bonds to what are now called legal tender. And now your dollar bill says right on it, what?
Federal Reserve notes.
Federal Reserve notes, that's right. And it says right on there, this is legal tender for all debts. You say, based on what? Based on the fact that the government said so. And whenever they need more money in circulation, they just put more money in circulation, but the money itself has no intrinsic value anymore. Consequently, it was a real easy leap to go from physical dollar bills and coins, you know, that have no intrinsic value, to pieces of plastic, and now it's digits. I get paid electronically.
Zeros and ones.
It's all zeros and ones, yes, with no intrinsic value. And so I get paid electronically. Every 15th and 1st, I go online. I don't even open my checkbook or go to the bank or hand anybody money. I just go online, and sure enough, there's more money in my account. And then I pay my bills online with those electronic digits that showed up in my account. Click, 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 click. I've paid all my bills in 10 minutes. I sit down twice a month and do that, and I never see the money. I never see another human being. I never count out some bearer bonds to them and say, here, I've paid that. It's just automatic electronic funds transferring. Now, of course, the big talk in our society today is the cashless society. Get rid of cash altogether because there's so much cash moving around in the drug trade. Well, two things. The drug trade, and there's so much duplication and forgery going on in the world. You could really stop the counterfeiting trade and the drug trade if you just said, okay, all that money you've got doesn't have any value anymore. You're done. Oh, well, that comes to a fairly screeching halt because it's much easier to trace and follow money that's moving electronically. So if you say only electronic money can be used now, that becomes a very good law enforcement tool, and we're headed that way like a steam train going downhill. I mean, we're just headed straight for the cashless society. Well, once you're at cashless society, there's no difficulty in telling everybody, oh, yeah, and you can't access your money unless you do it this way. So we live in a time when it's not hard for us to imagine an announcement that says you can't buy, sell, or trade unless you have this, whatever the this is.
I just heard on the radio the other day that they're one way they're talking about tracking the immigrants is to give them a chip.
Because those RFID chips already exist and because they've been proven to be medically viable, I think you're just going to see them keep growing and growing and growing. And they're already really advocating to people having babies these days that they put the chip in the kid while they're, as soon as they're born, so that if they're ever kidnapped or misplaced or wander off, you can just use the satellite to track them, find them, and bring them back. And it's amazing.
It's a wonderful idea, you know, but
I'll say what's that.
Same time.
Yes, we can see the upside of all this stuff. So in any case, just that very fact that we all went, well, I can see benefit to that. Sure, I get that. My point is, though, what I'm saying is you see us as a society. You see us as a world system, as a world economic system. You can see us growing that direction regardless.
Yeah.
It's all just headed there regardless.
Right, right.
Well, talks about even some of the elect may be deceived.
That's right. That's why he's going to sell.
That's why the elect will be gone. Absolutely. Exactly right. And he will protect his elect. He will make sure that we do not fall for that stuff. But my point is how quick and how easily will the world fall for it, especially if the influence of the church and the Holy Spirit is not here, people will line up for it. If you've worked all your life, you've put all your money away, you're looking forward to either retiring or being able to pay your bills, even feed your children, and somebody says, well, now you got to have this, people are going to go, well, sure, yes, okay, fine, I'll take that. Because I got to get my money, I got to feed my kids, I got to pay my bills, I got to have it. Makes it much easier. It's more convenient, it's fine, I'll take it.
Sometimes you got to sketch it and wonder, how come people can see trends coming and they don't get out of the way? For example, say you're a Jew in Poland and they're messing with the Jews. I forget which order the countries fell, but you're one of the third or fourth countries that Hitler takes over. Why were you there?
Yeah, Hitler is, what, 60 years ago? And exterminated 6 million Jews successfully before finally the nations of the world said, oh, okay, now you're going to have to cut that out. It's only 60 years ago. I mean, that's, you know, I'm 50, and 10 years before me, this was all going on. It's just not that hard for me to imagine a ruler rising up that says, let's exterminate Jews, and the world going, yeah, okay. Yeah, we're okay with that. And that will, again, be one of the hallmarks of that beast Antichrist character. We like to think that we are, that we have progressed so far and that we've grown so much as a people and that we have matured so much that that would never happen again, the Holocaust. But now you've got the president of Iran over there saying that the Holocaust never happened. So I saw thrones and they that sat on them. Judgment was given to them. I saw the souls of them that were beheaded because of the testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God. And those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received the mark upon their forehead and upon their hands, and they came to life and they reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Let's talk one more time about who those people have to be. We just agreed that the church would be gone. Right? That the church is gone before the tribulation, and these that were beheaded were obviously beheaded during the tribulation. So who are they? They're Israelites. They have to be. They have to be the beginning of...
Not Jews, you're right, Israelites. Because
Israelites, not Judahites specifically, yeah.
Right, they could have been the other 10 tribes.
Right, because you've got the 144,000 who are 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel who are going out preaching to the collective Israel that is scattered around the world. And so, of course, as the anti-Israel movement continues on, then these, the 144,000 in specific, who are identified as having the mark of God in their forehead, which I find, you know, to be a perfect contrast to all those in the earth who have the mark in their right hand in their forehead of the beast, they're going to be the 144,000 who are marked, stamped in their forehead with the mark of God. Well, that's going to be an irritant to all those who have the mark of the beast. Of course they're going to want those people gone. That makes complete sense to me. And they will refuse to worship the beast. And so they, of course, are going to have to be done away with as well.
They are going to be the ultimate of racists, and that's how they're going to
be. Oh, absolutely. They're going to be accused of...
You think you're better than us because you have that mark.
Yep, I see that.
And they're going to say that what you're spreading is hate speech?
Yes.
And you're looking down on us?
Us with our beautiful...
Exactly. Come on, right-hand forehead people. Do away with the mark of God people. I mean, you can see that. They came to life and they reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead, who is the rest of the dead at that point?
The people who died that weren't God's people.
Right, the people who were not God's people. The rest of the dead. Remember that we've just talked about a first resurrection. There is a resurrection of all those who belong to God at the beginning of the 1,000 years. And they rule and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead... which means all those who were not resurrected in the first resurrection, the rest of the dead did not live until the 1,000 years were over. So during that 1,000 years, you have the people of God resurrected at the beginning of the 1,000 years to rule and reign with Christ for 1,000 years, which they could do because they've already died and resurrected, so they're no longer subject to death or sickness or decay, so they could live 1,000 years on earth, could rule and reign with Christ for that 1,000 years. But during that time, the rest of the dead, the ones who are going to be judged, who do not belong to God's people, do not rise up and are not resurrected till the 1,000 years are over. It's very, very plain language, and again, every translator agrees with that language.
Would you say the rest of them got 1,000 years of grace?
I understand what you're saying, yes. I mean, they got 1,000 years of reprieve from the judgment in the lake of fire, yes. But if you think about Jesus saying Lazarus and the rich man, and that Lazarus went to Abraham's bosom, and the rich man said, I'm in torment, dip your finger in some water and give it to me, then even before that judgment, if they're in some place, a holding place, Hades, it says death, hell, and the grave, give up the dead that are in them. None of those are pretty pictures. I guess the most you could hope for is that while they're going through that period of time, that they're less conscious of what they're enduring. Or they've got 1,000 years of enduring the reality that they're about to be judged by God, and that the pain they're enduring at that moment is nothing like what's coming up after the judgment. But that's just really, really hard stuff to conceive of, isn't it? We've had comfortable lives. I mean, we breathe air-conditioned air and walk on carpet and drive air-conditioned cars and have the best quality of food at drive-thrus in the history of the world. And so we're very comfortable and we like comfort. The idea of absolute, utter, nonstop, forever torment is so hard for us to conceive of. And yet that's as real biblically as the idea of heaven and bliss and paradise. But yes, every day this side of the lake of fire is grace. I'll give you that too. There are both Jews and Gentiles, Israelites and Gentiles, that endure the tribulation period.
Okay.
Especially those, by the way, that are in Ammon and Moab and Edom, who are the Israelites who were told to flee. Even Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel, then flee into the wilderness. They would look at Daniel and he would tell them where to go, Moab, Edom, Ammon. And they would be in the wilderness, the same way that the woman flees into the wilderness in the book of Revelation, and that there God takes care of her for 42 months, 3.5 years, all that stuff. And they are called the remnant of Israel that survives that tribulation period. They are the first people who enter into the millennial kingdom and are redeemed by the return of Christ. And Zechariah says that when he returns and his foot touches the Mount of Olives, that the Israelites will look on him as him that they have pierced. They will see him whom they have pierced and weep over him like a mother weeps over her only child. And so it will be the return of the actual Christ that will be the catalyst for the redemption and faith that will happen to Israel nationally, which is why Isaiah said it'll be like a nation born in a day.
So there's kind of two groups that are actually going to make it to heaven. There's the dead in Christ that go through the first resurrection, and then there's those that go through the tribulation, some of them.
Yeah. But I would also try to expand your thinking a little bit. Standard Christian theology says saved go to heaven. But that's not really the biblical picture all the time. You've got a 1,000-year millennium on earth. The nation of Israel is redeemed. But what that redemption is redemption to the kingdom they've always been promised. And they come up out of their graves and they rule and reign and are with Christ on earth. And then after that 1,000 years is up, the next phase is new heavens, new earth. Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, comes down out of heaven to earth. So when you say heaven, don't think of it as everybody dies and then you get a harp on a cloud and you hang out in heaven with God. The reality is God created the universe on purpose and created the earth on purpose and will restore it to everything he intended it to be, where his people will also live. But we will have the kind of glorified bodies like Christ has, where we're as comfortable living on earth as we are being at the throne of God. And by the way, let me also add, when you say new heavens and new earth, the new heaven is not the heaven where God reigns. Paul talks about the third heaven where God is. The first heaven is the atmosphere around the earth, the birds that fly in the heavens, same language. The second heavens are where the stars are, the firmament, that thing. The third heaven is where God reigns. There's no reason to remake the third heaven. The third heaven is perfect. New heavens, new earth means new atmosphere, new planet. And so God is going to restore the planet to its original pristine condition, and then it's going to be inhabited forever in a heavenly context, but still an earthly context. Make sense? So,
Are there any Israelites that will not be redeemed?
Sure. When Jesus said to the Pharisees, how will you escape the fires of hell, where the fires never quench, where the worm never sleeps? You're of your father, the devil. Yeah, there's no doubt. But when Paul says, and so all Israel will be saved, in that context, he talked about the cutoff branches that are going to be restored. Historically, the cutoff branches were those northern tribes that ever since the Assyrian captivity have been scattered and not brought back to their land. That's why it's so important. That's three so's for really extra emphasis. It's important that you recognize then that God returns not only to the Jews, but he returns to Israel nationally, and that all the promises made in the Old Testament to Israel nationally include all 12 tribes. So when Paul, after the cross in Romans 11, talks about all Israel being saved, it's because he says those cut off branches will be put back into the natural root because it's their promise to begin with.
Not individually, but all the tribes.
Right. So it doesn't have to be every individual. It has to be the national tribes. And that's why the book of Revelation picks up 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, then you see the beginning of the restoration of national Israel that Paul promised after the cross, that all of the prophets promised before the cross. it's so consistent all the way through the Bible that, yeah, it's going to be representatives of all 12 tribes nationally, but it doesn't have to be every individual. Does that make sense?
Okay.
The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were completed. This is verse 5. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. So there's that mathematic number again. And so all of humanity at this point is broken one more time into two groups. And again, you see this all the way through the Bible. You see God looking at all of humanity as either his people or not his people. It goes all the way back to Genesis. It goes back to the Garden of Eden. It goes back to God saying to the serpent that he was going to place enmity between the children of the serpent, the seed of the serpent, and the seed of the woman. And that one day the seed of the woman was going to crush the head of the serpent, but it was going to bruise his heel. And ever since Eden, God has always seen all of humanity broken into seed of the serpent, seed of the woman, the redeemed people, and the lost people. And there's no gray area in the middle. There's always those that by God's grace are the saved, redeemed, chosen, elect people, and there's the rest of the people. And you see language in like the Thessalonian letters where Paul says that during the time when the beast is on the earth, that they will believe that lie because God will turn them over to a strong delusion that they will believe the lie and all be damned. And you go, wow, Paul, what are you saying there? Well, that can only be if God already knows these are mine and these are not, and those I turn over to the delusion, those are all going to be condemned and these are all going to be saved because they're mine. The Bible always speaks in that kind of very black and white, saved and lost language. And you see it one more time here. Blessed and holy are those who have part in the first resurrection. Now, is that because they were better than other people or smarter or quicker or made good choices or got themselves into the first resurrection, knew where to be, signed up for it? It is a matter of God's grace that some people are going to be in the first resurrection. And the ones who aren't are the rest of the dead. And the rest of the dead don't live till the 1,000 years are up. And then death, hell, the grave, the sea, all give up the dead that are in them. And they all end up standing in front of the white throne. And God opens the books and he judges every one of them on their works. And then it says he opens the book of life. And everyone whose name is not found in the book of life from the foundation of the world is put into the lake of fire. The language is just that exacting. We're not always comfortable with the idea of a God that is that sovereign and that exacting. But it's the only God you find in the Bible. And so if we're going to be consistent biblically, we see that ever since Eden and all the way here at the end of Revelation, you've still got God determining the ultimate fate and destiny of every person because he's a king on his throne and he does whatever he wants with what he's created. And if that's the fact and you can see yourself in the saved group, then hit your knees. And say thank you yet again, over and over again, because there are a whole lot of people he's not just passing over, but people who, like Pharaoh, he hardened his heart so that he could show his power in him. Thessalonian letter says the same thing. He's going to turn people over to a strong delusion so that they will believe the lie. That's a really, really sovereign God. So if out of the mass of humanity that he's passing over, he has chosen to reveal himself to you and open up his word to you and give you the confidence that you can go running to the throne of grace crying, Abba, Father, then recognize the gift that that is and just keep thanking him over and over again for it. And I have no trouble praising or glorifying a God like that. A God that sovereign who would be that kind to me. I'm there. I am completely worshiping and celebrating that God. I don't know, these people who have that little tiny small God who's waiting around for you to do something, who would really like to save everybody but just doesn't seem to be able, and who's waiting around for somebody to come validate him. Not only is that God not in the Bible anywhere, but I don't know why I would worship such a God. Seems to want to do things and just doesn't have the ability and is waiting around for his creatures to validate the plan he started, but his hands are tied, and if they of their free will choose not to cooperate, well then he's out of luck again. I mean, why would you worship him? Especially if you do get to heaven, you'd be able to say, well, it's really lucky for you I chose, huh?
Yeah.
me and these five chose to come in. You're lucky we got in.
Well, worse than that, you had a pride monger say, isn't it a good thing that I got all these people to come and bow and say the sinner's prayer?
Yeah, right. You're right. It's all about that pride thing. And Paul makes sure to eliminate that when he writes, by grace are you saved through faith. You should not only have this memorized word for word, but I have it on a tie. So, I mean, it's, by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is a gift of God. What's the next phrase? Not of works, lest any man should boast. Nobody's going to get to boast when they get to heaven and say, boy, it's a good thing. I did my stuff. That's why I got saved.
That's why that one got saved. I prayed for that one. And that, you know.
And, yeah. It's a good thing we kicked in our part, God, or it would have been real lonely in eternity. Just you up here waiting for somebody to come visit. No, the God who promised his son, who told his son. I mean, when you think about the language of the lamb slain before the foundation of the world, what does that mean? Why would there be a lamb slain before the foundation of the world unless there was the anticipation that there were going to be people who would need a slain lamb for their redemption, and unless there was the anticipation that there would be saved people? God knew from the beginning what he was going to do. And his son was going to be the fail-safe and the redemption for all those people he chose before the foundation of the world. And that plan can't be changed. It is eternally, irrevocably established in the mind and heart of God. And just so that nobody could think it was a Kreskin trick, he wrote it down. I mean, he wrote it down in his book of names, and he wrote it down in his Bible, and he said, this is how it works.
I think we are, they would say, what we are. You think you're the only people going to heaven? I said, you're going to be boastful about the fact that you made it to heaven.
Now, people like to do that kind of stuff on you just because they... You know, those little ad hominem attacks where if you say God is in control and sovereign and he decides these things, and they'll say, oh, well, then you think you're the only one that goes to heaven. And the answer I usually give is, no, I just thank God that I know I'm going to heaven. Now you better think about yourself. You know? I mean, is that really the attitude that you're going to carry with you to heaven? You might want to rethink that. So, any questions about that? Okay, I have one last question. Is the text clear then?
Couldn't be clearer.
Is the text ambiguous in any way? Well, then I got to go with the text. I got to say, this is what it says, therefore that has to be what it means, and therefore I'm going with the text. And that's just the only approach I can think to take. It's the only approach that makes sense.
Thank you for joining us for this week's study. We invite you back next week for another Salvation by Grace message.